Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the news and politics editor at Crosscut. Washington is generally thought of as a very blue state. It's been decades since it elected a Republican governor, president, or U.S. senator. And Democrats currently have the majority in the state legislature. But with another gubernatorial race around the corner, Republican leaders are gearing up for a potential shift. Crosscut gathered a panel of Republican heavyweights from the region to discuss changes in the party and its future in Washington state. Rob McKenna is a practicing attorney and former Washington State Attorney General. He is currently president of the National Association of Attorneys General, and he ran for Washington State Governor in 2012, losing a close race against current Governor Jay Inslee. Maya Espinoza is executive director and founder of the Center for Latino Leadership, a civic engagement-focused nonprofit based in Washington State. She is also a small business owner and was legislative liaison to the Governor's Commission on Hispanic Affairs in 2017. Kim Wyman is serving her second term as Washington's Secretary of State. She was the second woman elected to that office in state history. She previously served as Thurston County Elections Director and Thurston County Auditor. Representative J.T. Wilcox is the House Republican leader in the State House of Representatives. He grew up on a farm in Washington, and his legislative priorities include finding sustainable solutions for the state's small towns and cities. Crosscut Editor-at-Large Knute Berger moderated the discussion. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast and the Washington Policy Center. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
Hello. Thanks for coming in. It's a beautiful day. And hopefully we're going to have a really good, interesting conversation about the future of the Republican Party in Washington State. I'm going to briefly introduce the panelists. Rob McKenna, former state attorney general, former a lot of things in politics, and a nurturer of mainstream Republicans over the years, and a gubernatorial candidate. Next to him is J.T. Wilcox, who's the Republican House Minority Leader in Olympia, and a dairy farmer down in Pierce County, or raised a dairy farmer. Now you're into eggs, right? The family, Wilcox Farms. Maya Espinoza ran for the legislature and has been working on getting more Latinos into politics. And on the end, Kim Wyman, who is the highest elected Republican state official, Secretary of State. So. I wanted to begin by just outlining very, very briefly some of the issues, which is, politics in Washington have been somewhat increasingly divided in terms of both East and West, but also as pollster Stuart Elway, who I think is somewhere here in the audience, Stuart has pointed out that the divide often is between urban and rural. You have rural areas in western Washington that vote very much like rural areas in eastern Washington, and likewise cities like Spokane that vote increasingly like Seattle. One of the issues I think that the Republican Party has is that most of the growth in the state is in the urban areas. So over the next 10 years, Washington is projected to get somewhere around 700,000 new residents. 70% of those will be in the four central Puget Sound counties, King County, Pierce County, Snohomish County, and Kitsap County. And these counties already account for about 54% of the vote and are increasingly blue as the suburbs have moved in recent years into the Democratic column. So what I want to talk to the panelists today is about the future of the party and what are the strategies and also what are the policies for becoming... Well, for example, we haven't elected a Republican governor in Washington State since 1980.
Well,
that's
2004.
Well, feisty.
Oh, boy, here we go.
Yeah. Yes, but for, what was it, 41 votes?
29
votes. Okay. So it's been a while, let's just say. So... And I'm going to start out by asking each of the panelists a question individually, and then we'll go to more of a general group discussion. I want to start out with Secretary Kim Wyman. And my question for you is, you're able to get votes in Western Washington. You're the highest elected Republican official in the state. It's kind of a tradition that we've been electing secretaries of state from that are Republican. But I'm wondering if you could kind of tell us, what is the Kim Wyman secret? What is the path, the Kim Wyman path to success?
Well, I think the main thing is, first and foremost, I came into this job and this role with a background in elections. So I started in Thurston County as a staff and worked for Sam Reed when he was the county auditor and ran the elections division. And I did that for about 10 years learning the field and learned the importance of nonpartisanship. And I think it really served me well when that position became vacant and I went for the appointment. I had close friends, because it was a political appointment, I had to actually say out loud in Olympia that I was a Republican. It's a lot like doing that here, by the way. I had very close friends who came up to me and said, and they always whisper, by the way, "You're a Republican." And they were shocked. And what that told me was I had really done my job well, because they didn't know my party affiliation. And that's been a core principle that I've held every time I've ran for not only county auditor, but for Secretary of State. And I think that it's not a partisan issue. And the two times I've been on the statewide ballot, my opponents have actually been more partisan in the way they ran their campaigns. And I think that what resonated, particularly the last time, is that it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat, a Republican, a Libertarian, a Green Party member, or anywhere else on the spectrum, we all want fair, accurate, accessible, secure elections. And I think that you know, if I had an overarching theme on this panel and response, it would be that's the thing that Republicans need to get back to, and that whatever office they're running for, you have to get to those core principle-driven and centered ideas that resonate with not just the base of your party, but those middle voters, because the middle voters decide it. And I think that oftentimes that's been the biggest challenge, is we are putting people that don't fit their district or are running for an office that maybe their background or the way they're approaching the campaign doesn't really fit.
JT, I wanted to ask you, you're fresh from the legislative wars and with the session, and I, we've had a chance to talk off and on over the last year, and I was wondering, what have you learned? What did you learn from this session about the prospects ahead for the party, looking at 2020, but also beyond, in terms of legislation, ideas, and trends within the party that you think are positive?
Well, you know, one of the things that's really interesting about the jobs that I've had in the legislature, I was floor leader for 6 years and then caucus leader for the last year. These are the jobs where you have to focus on the session itself the most and on the debate itself the most. And I honestly struggle with trying to change gears from kind of a legislative world to an election world. But you set up elections to some extent with the arguments that you make during the session. You get a few metrics. I do weekly reviews, both on email and in videos. And the thing that people respond to the most this year, and it's very, very consistent, is the idea that there was enough revenue to take care of the priorities of Washington State. There was no necessity for new taxes. I think there's a certain amount of frustration that the other side, you know, just couldn't understand that reality. And then at the end of the session, I think that there was some broad agreement that there's something wrong with the process. You saw that come out the most mid-session when out of the blue there came a bill that would have effectively put most independent cosmetologists out of business. They wouldn't be self-employed anymore. And we haven't seen that kind of turnout of just grassroots people since Occupy Olympia. And that was kind of two different sorts of groups.
Cosmetologists,
yes. And it's because they were unexpectedly threatened, and their question was, how could this happen? No one told us. It can just show up in the middle of a session. And then as we got towards the end of the session, there was a lot of process concerns with title-only bills being dropped in the last few days. One of them even passed through the Finance Committee with no bill, just a title, and it came out finally with a series of taxes in the last couple of days of the legislature. And that just made people feel like, even though we have a majority that controls both chambers and they can essentially do what they want, wouldn't it have been easier for them to be more transparent? Why do we have to feel afraid that at the whims of circumstance and because we're unpopular in the moment, that we're going to be targeted? So those are two things that I think have resonance now, but we're a long ways away from the next election, and we may have different issues then.
Hey, Rob, I wanted to ask you, partly because we got to know each other when I was at Eastside Week on the East Side, and you were a figure in the county council and a figure in Bellevue. And one of the things that was pretty dramatic in the last legislative election was the wipeout of moderate Republicans, so-called, in west of the mountains and in the greater Seattle area, King County in particular.
Right.
I think there's no legislative district that's contained within King County that's represented by a Republican now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So that's a very large and important shift, and it is driven by a couple of factors. One is that the parties are not as diverse as they used to be. If you go back even 10 years, 20 years, each party would have more diversity in it ideologically within that caucus, within each caucus, than you do now, where the Democrats tend to be more uniformly to the left and the Republicans more uniformly to the right. Second big transitional factor has been demographic change. You've already touched on that, but the rapid population growth, the influx of people coming into Washington State and into the Seattle metropolitan area particularly, including the King County suburbs, has driven it's driven more change politically with more people being elected as Democrats, that's for sure. It's been happening very rapidly and just in a couple of cycles. I mean, I won in 2004, my first election for AG, by 9% statewide, got a decent percentage in King County, and in 2008, won by 17 points running for re-election, and if I didn't carry King County, I came pretty close. Politics shifting, and with demographics shifting, we find ourselves where we are. Meanwhile, other parts of the state are going the other direction, with the 19th District, Southwest Washington, electing Republicans. So the spin cycle seems to be accelerating, the centrifugal effect with the rural-urban divide that you described, and you're certainly seeing that more in the suburbs, reflected more in the suburbs around Seattle. Maybe a little less so in Pierce County, which seems to be, we've seen some Republican trends, but in King County, it's unmistakable.
Maya, you ran for the legislature, 28th district, right? Am I right? So we're
right.
Talking about just south of Tacoma?
So Pierce County entirely.
Pierce County.
Tacoma, University Place, Lakewood, Steilacoom, DuPont.
One of the things you've been trying to do is encourage the party to be more diverse. And can you tell us about that effort and how's it going?
Sure. So first, I want to thank you for putting together a panel like this at a festival like this. I think it's incredible first step and a true testament to diversity and inclusion when you're including Republicans in the conversation. So you're correct that I have been encouraging and maybe leading by example within the Republican Party to show that, Latinos don't belong to one party. In fact, no racial demographic should be prescribed that way. Thank you. So my work has been, I've worked within the legislature as a caucus aide, I guess you could say, and then I've also worked for a governor's commission, the Governor's Commission on Hispanic Affairs, where I was actually advising from the governor's commission, so representing a very different perspective, doing my job that way, JT, right? But I would have to relate and... JT actually brought me in one day and asked me to present on the issue was real ID, marking driver's license as not valid for federal purposes. And so I had to help, or I was asked to present on how this affects constituents east of the mountains. I said, look, I can help with that. I tried to illustrate kind of a scenario that maybe JT or some of the other caucus members in the House Republicans wouldn't maybe relate to or be totally familiar with. So I tried to make it in relatable terms just to show, nobody's pointing the finger or we don't need to point blame. We don't need to make it partisan, but there is an underlying issue and perhaps fear that goes along with this. And so I try my best to show that both to the Republicans that, not all of us belong to one party and we don't have to be that way, but also to my Latino community that some of our values do align with the Republican Party. And for that reason, I am a Republican. I ran as one, and I'd like to be. The part of the reason why I ran while Trump is in office is that I wanted to make that distinction that these are my conservative values and they are different from the capitalist in the White House.
JT, I want to just keying off of that a little bit. How is the diversity program going in the Republican Party? Are you guys making headway?
You can't laugh.
Well, it sounds like some people don't think so. We have an interesting challenge in our caucus. We have a more diverse caucus than we've had in the past. The last election, the first openly gay Republican was elected to be a House Republican. And shortly afterwards, Alex Ibarra, a Hispanic Republican, was appointed serve in, I think, the 13th district. And it's funny, I've had press questions kind of inviting me to highlight these people, and I've gone and asked them, how do you want me to respond to those questions? And what I hear consistently is, I want to be a great legislator. I have conservative values. I've been a Republican since I began voting. I want to be known as a great legislator. I don't want to be a hyphenated legislator. And it's my job to respect that. It means that it's a little harder for me to go out and highlight the fact that we've got more diversity than we had in the past. But my first job, I think, is to respect the people that elect them, respect the people that serve in my caucus. And I've also gone back and checked with both of these when there were votes that I thought might be difficult for them. And one thing that we do in our caucus is, and this is a little easier because we're the minority caucus, we don't tell people how to vote. I can think of once or twice this year when I indicated I hope that we're all together on this, and please let me know if we're not. And I've wanted to make darn sure, first of all, that if they're going to differ from our caucus, they're not going to suffer any criticism inside the caucus. And second of all, I want to make sure that when they're conforming to what most of us do, it's because it's what's in their heart. Not because they think they have to do this, because they're in the House Republican caucus. And what I've heard every time is, JT, I know that I can vote the way that I want. And Alex Ibarra in particular has many times said, I was a little concerned about this vote. I went back and talked to my family and talked to my Hispanic friends, and they're with me. So we are more diverse. We've got a long ways to go. We know that. And we're going to do it, I think, in our way, which is very respectful about the rights of individuals to differ from us in ideological terms. And the success of these two, I think, are going to make a big difference for all of us.
Well, because you brought up the diversity question in terms of ideology, I'm going to have to ask you about Matt Shea, and someone who represents, I think most people would agree, pretty extreme views, although he's consistently been reelected by his constituents. And I know that you've got some questions about some of the things he's been involved in. I wonder if you could talk about that. And, you know, how do you deal in the caucus with somebody who has, what appear to be white supremacist, possibly coddling violent extremists, et cetera?
Well, first of all, as I said, when some very shocking news stories came out recently, I totally reject that violent language that wasn't used by him, but it was used by somebody in a chat that he was involved in. We totally condemn that. All of us should understand that political violence can be a cancer. I mean, we see all over the world what that does to countries that often enjoyed peace and prosperity and are brought down by violent extremists that can't really get along. So, A, I reject that. I absolutely agree. Matt should have rejected that in the moment, and I wish he had. I was asked, what are we going to do about it towards the end of the session? And my answer is this. Every one of the caucuses over the last several years have had to go through a process with members that had been accused of stepping out of line in major ways. And I've dealt with that. Even though I've only been a caucus leader for a year, I was in a position where it seemed right to ask a member to step down. That's why Alex Ibarra was appointed to be part of our caucus, so I'm not a bit afraid to do that. Every single caucus has gone through a process where they do an investigation that's careful, that's independent, and I would also say I'm aware of a few of these where the person that was accused was found to be not guilty, not in a criminal sense. These weren't criminal investigations, but not guilty of the allegations that were made. And so, again, I reject the things that were said in that conversation. We do have a broad ideology, and we also respect the heck out of the fact that 130,000 people are invited to go to the polls and vote, and their choice is important. But we're going to go through a process, just like all the other caucuses have done.
Well, this, looking ahead at 2020, and any of you can answer this, but I'm going to hope, Rob, you start. So in Washington State, I think in particular, the elephant in the room is Donald Trump. He's not an invisible elephant, right? He's a very visible, very vocal, very Twitter-friendly. And I'm wondering, how does the state party deal with that in terms of trying to expand its appeal as opposed to just embracing the base? What do you guys do strategically?
Well, the state party is led by a very smart, capable young guy who's the youngest state party leader we've had in a long time, Caleb Heimlich. He's very talented. And he hasn't asked me for advice, but if he did, I would advise him to stay focused on the policies and on the reality on the ground in this country. Going into the 2020 election, we're likely to have a strong economy, continuing low unemployment, low inflation, the best economic circumstances this country has seen since the late 1960s, except at that time, a good part of the economic growth is being driven by the Vietnam War, and the economy was visibly overheating by the guns and butter strategy that LBJ decided to pursue. So did Congress. So he's going to have, and the party's going to have a set of objective facts which are pretty favorable. At the same time, the president is a very polarizing figure, and it will be an issue that every candidate will have to deal with. Kim will be on the ballot and will be asked over and over again, are you voting for President Trump for re-election? Legislators will as well. And so
can she say no?
Well, I think it's difficult in the following sense, that, you know, we were a two-party system in this country, and people typically will end up supporting the person who's wearing their team's jersey, even if they don't personally like him or her. So it puts elected officials in a particularly difficult position if they're uncomfortable with the person in power. But at the same time, I think you have to give the voters a little credit for not basing their vote for one candidate or incumbent based on who someone else is in office. If it were all about who is running for president or is president, Kim wouldn't be sitting here as the Secretary of State today. And while the JT and the Senate are currently in the minority, it's not as bad as it was coming out of the 2006 midterms when the controversy over the Iraq War absolutely destroyed us, we were so far in the hole, it looked like that was the end. We're never going to get out of it. But of course, we did. Ended up coming back to within two votes in the state house and ended up controlling the state senate for a number of years. My point is just this: nothing stays the same forever. And regardless of what happens in 2020, there will be a new set of circumstances after 2020 as a result of that. And none of us can really sit here and predict exactly what those will be like, except I will say the pendulum does tend to swing, and the pendulum is likely to move again after 2020, depending on who's elected. That'll determine the direction it moves. And then the final point I'll make is this, that in this state, you have two major political parties who account together for about 55% of self-identified voters. And the other 45% say they're independents. And so the battlefield will continue to be after 2020 and in 2020, the competition for those independent votes. Those independent voters are the ones who are going to put Kim Wyman back in as Secretary of State, for example.
Where in central Puget Sound is there opportunity for Republican candidates? It was mentioned at Pierce County, maybe a little bit. I don't know about Thurston County, but no. Kim, you know that really well. I'm trying to think. I mean, it sounds like you think in 2020 that the pendulum's going to keep going maybe the Democrat way for a little bit, partly because, state Democrats are smart to nationalize the election with somebody as unpopular here as Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think that would be the logical strategy for them to pursue. Then the likelihood is they'll go too far in the other direction, as we already started to see in the legislative session here with a whole lot of tax increases, even with the best state budget we've ever seen, and very rapid growth in state tax revenues without new taxes. So the likelihood is there'll be a reaction back the other way, just as there was after 2006. That'd be my prediction.
Well, I wonder if each of you could address this. Let's start with you, Maya. we can talk about strategy, which district, or which candidate, but I think the policy issues are interesting. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed, back in the day, back in the 1960s and 70s, Seattle had Republicans, and in fact, they were a force for reform in Seattle in that time period. Sorry, nobody really remembers that now unless you were alive then.
I've read about it.
You've read about it. Yeah, no, it was a very thing. And we had Republican urbanists, the pea patches, the historic preservation, economic development. The Republican urbanists embraced the city. Now I feel like there's been a retreat from the city in terms of policy. And if you're gonna get votes, you've gotta have, I would think, policies that reach out beyond the base, but that also reflect where the growth is. And I'm wondering, Maya, if you could start, like, in terms of policies, what are things that you would like to see the Republican Party adopt in terms of Central Puget Sound, that could begin to appeal and solve problems in the urban area,
sure,
provide an alternative.
Yeah, so you take what people are interested in and you sell it. That's what Republicans are good at, capitalizing on. So right now it's environmentalism is one of the biggest things. So how can we make environmentalism profitable, economically make sense for us? And my policy advice to the caucus, and something that I would strive to do as maybe a legislator someday, we'll see how this goes,
I hope so,
is to create creative policies like that, to talk with both sides about what the objectives are, how we can get there without increasing taxes or by using our existing tax base in a new way. And obviously negotiation goes, you know, as far one direction and the other. But in this case right now, it's a little bit difficult for a Republican to propose a good idea. I think we've got a number of legislators that have been. What was it? Representative Griffey just passed a human trafficking bill that he'd been working on for 5 years. What was the problem? Why did it take 5 years? A Republican was sponsoring it, unfortunately. I mean, that's what I found in working in Olympia, one-on-one. I've got this great piece of legislation for Latinos. It does this, this, and that. We think I've got all the Republicans on board. Sorry, it's got a Republican's name on it. Who are we helping? It's about the policies, but it's also about the political power and reaching across the aisle, really building and reestablishing relationships. And because of the partisanship and polarization that we have going on right now, it's you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. Make a friend on the other side and you lose some on this side. So it's got to go beyond policies. We actually deeply rely on Democrats to help champion these good ideas and have them make sense for all of us. So sure, we can come up with creative policy ideas all day, and I think that's the right way to go. But until the other side allows that contribution, it doesn't matter right now.
Kim?
Well, having the vantage point in the other branch and never having to, you know, be in the legislative branch, I don't have the patience for it, I don't think. My observation on a couple levels, I think one of the things that the Republican Party doesn't do as well as the Democratic Party is messaging. And we can give you studies and we can give you data and we can tell you why you should believe in this because we have the data to show it to you. And what I think that the Democratic Party, particularly in this state, does a very good job at is they make it about people and the impact of people at their kitchen table. And they, yes, and I'm giving you a big compliment here in public, Tina. I think that's one of the things. And if you go back a few years and you look at initiatives that have passed, we've had a number of initiatives that have struck down the very things we talk about ad nauseum, lower taxes. You know, we voted down an income tax hike. We've voted down, and of course right now I'm blanking on them, but there's 3 to 4 initiatives that have gone down in flames statewide. And in those same elections, voters went over there and voted for, you know, that other guy that does the initiative gathering that I'm not going to say his name of, and then voted a straight Democratic ticket. That's a message disconnect, because those people are Republican voters. They just don't know it because they don't see it because we can't get that message out. So I think that, you know, as I look to the upcoming elections, that's one of the things we have to be better at is not trying to explain, not trying to convince you all that we're right and you should believe us. We've got to show you why it makes a difference in your family, in your house, to your wallet. And until we do that, we're not going to get those swing middle voters. And then you have that secondary tier that I think that the Democratic Party does better than we do, is they're really good at putting issues out that divide people, and particularly divide the Republican Party. And it's that damned if you do, damned if you don't. So if I support it, I'm going to lose the base. If I go against it, I'm going to lose the middle. And so I think that's the secondary thing. I think that 1-2 punch, and then the third level is we have to reflect Washington State. One of the things I'm really proud of that I've gotten to work on nationally, because I try not to play too much in politics here because of the job, is a couple of initiatives on the Republican side at the national level to get more candidates of color who are Republican, they just maybe don't know it or haven't had the infrastructure to run, and women. You know, right women right now. I would like to see more women on my side you know, get out and run more. And so I think it's kind of a multi-tiered thing, but it needs to happen.
Policy. You guys.
You want to go first? I got some ideas.
Yeah, happy to. And I'll be brief so we get Rob's. You know, where I think we fall down to some extent is we really believe you represent your district. And when you localize an election, it often is a good strategy. We tell our members, you go out and vote your district, right? You're not representing the Washington State House Republicans, you're representing the 7th District, for example. That doesn't lend itself to consistent messaging, which becomes a problem. It's true, the other party does a better job of linking up to national messaging. And this is also a state where if you're going to turn everything into a base election, you know, there's more Democratic base here in Washington than there is Republican. I think where we can do, and we have room to do a better job, is we share a lot of the same goals, but we have different approaches, and we would like them to be more efficient. For example, carbon. The number one contributor to carbon across the state are wildfires. And we represent the areas that burn down. There's nobody that wants to control wildfire more than we do. That is the best carbon solution we could possibly have. Fish and orcas. The tribes know that there are three important things in terms of trying to rebuild Chinook stocks, which then rebuild orca stocks. That is managing predators, filling up the hatcheries, and protecting and restoring habitat. Those three things, nobody pushes harder than the House Republicans. And rather than just talking about them as individual little fixes, we also then need to tie it into the larger goal of people, which is to rebuild Puget Sound, rebuild the heritage that we have. And that's the way that we should message them.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that that the Republican approach to conservation needs to be amplified more greatly. There's a great history there, a great lineage there. So that's one. Number two, I think K-12 education will continue to be important. The House Democrats, in particular, are pushing us right off a cliff again by raising the local levy lid. So people are going to have, you know, higher local property taxes plus the biggest increase in state spending on K-12 ever. And that's ultimately going to be challenged in court. Number three, the you know, importance of higher education. The Republicans pushed for tuition cuts for our four-year schools, which was very successful, and timing was perfect because the economy is growing, the state budget was healthy. We give people a break by cutting tuition. Higher education is going to continue to be important as well. And I think those three issues, environmental, K-12, higher ed, along with the overarching theme of fiscal responsibility, is a winning recipe in the suburbs. Should be a winning recipe in the cities as well. The final point, Skip, is that neither party's policies exist in a vacuum. And so, whatever the Republicans propose is going to be contrasted to what the Democratic Party is proposing. And you know, they have their own challenges now with the you know, increasing tilt to the left and a pressure to go even farther to the left. This is why parties don't stay in power forever on either side, because over time, their internal dynamics cause them to move farther and farther away from the center, whether that's to the left or to the right. And then the voters say, oh, enough of that. Let's put the other guys in charge for a while.
That's the Slade-Gorton theory of parties' trends, right?
And it's in our country, it's particularly powerful because we're the only major country with representative democracy that has only two parties. There is no outlet, really, for a third or fourth or a fifth party where people can move, where you have to put together a coalition government, because our system, the way it was built in the Constitution, is not a parliamentary system. And so this phenomenon has been repeated over and over again throughout our country's history of the party in power being kicked out of power after a while because they moved too far away from the center.
When you go around the state, one of the things you hear... Are you signaling me? Are we ready to go to questions now? Oh, okay. I just want to get one question in before we go to the audience questions. Seattle bashing.
Yeah.
Is it good politics or bad politics? I mean, I...
Ask the farmer.
Yeah. Well, I'm tired of it. I've probably indulged in it a few times, but we're all absolutely fortunate that one of the world-class economic engines is right in our backyard here, or in your front yard if you live here. I'm grateful that we have this hot economy here. I'm grateful that we have culture here, opportunity. My son spent a few years working for Amazon. And it doesn't serve us well in strategic ways to be bashing Seattle all the time. What we also need to do, I think, is stretch out a little bit. We're not just a rural party. I may be a really rural guy. But we also have to represent the next tier of cities and the small towns and help people understand those areas have been crushed. And it's not because Seattle is malicious. It's hard to compete with Seattle. It's because we've created a situation where we have all the economy here, but we don't have enough housing. And out there, we've got all kinds of opportunities for housing, but we don't have any economy anymore. That's the fundamental conflict that we have to resolve. And so many of our problems revolve around there. And you know, bashing the 7th District or bashing Seattle doesn't solve it.
All right, well, I'm a tech monster here in the sense that I can destroy any operable technology with my brain.
Good one.
I've managed to lose what you just gave me.
No.
I'm a mossback. What do you expect? I tell people I went to high school with Bill Gates and we anchored opposite ends of the bell curve. But because he's not here, I'm not going to say which end he was on. We got a lot of questions here. Let me scroll through. Here's a good one. Would you rather see Jay Inslee elected to a third term as governor or elected president?
Next question.
Somebody's got to
actually. I've talked about this on KOW a number of times. I think it makes all the sense in the world for Jay to run. He loves campaigning, and he's got an issue to run on, and it's more fun than governing. So he's running, and it makes sense for him to do it. I think it's quite possible he'll run for a third term, actually, because I hope I'm not going out on a limb by saying this. I don't think he's going to be the nominee. And but that doesn't mean he shouldn't be running. Don't get me wrong. I don't mean that as a criticism. I think there are valid reasons to run in terms of driving an agenda. But, it could happen, it seems to me, that he gets to a certain point, runs out of money, and it's well before May of 2020, and he can still file for a third term because if he wants to get into the cabinet, he's better off doing that from the position of being a sitting governor than a former governor. So I think that could happen. It certainly is the biggest domino in the row that we're waiting to see what happens.
Right, yeah, I know that. Yeah. A lot of people are waiting with bated breath. Yes.
You know, we get served up these questions, and that was a very legitimate question. But it is a little bit of a symptom of what's happening in politics right now. I did an interview with a really great journalist, Brandy Cruz, earlier this week. It played yesterday, I think. And one of her questions was about Governor Inslee. And, you know, I'm a political opponent of Governor Inslee. And I think she was a little shocked. In fact, on the air, she said, well, I'm sure that there's others that are going to, share the dirt about the governor. One of the things that we need to do around here, I think, is to, when we're given an opportunity, and Rob, you weren't bashing, but I think the expectation with that question was, oh yeah, now they're going to tee off on Inslee. If you have to do that in a campaign, do it. But I think we all should take the opportunities not to bash each other, you know, our colleagues, the other side. At least not make it personal. I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. JT, I want you to take a crack at answering this. What is the Republican Party doing for indigenous people in Washington State? And I want you to answer that because I know a little bit about your family's background with Billy Frank.
Well, I really appreciate you asking that, and I almost feel like a Mike Hogg here. But first, Republicans should understand, and we mostly do, we represent virtually all of the tribal lands in Washington, all of the reservations. I mean, we really represent people, but we represent the places where the reservations are located. And at times we've had some feuds, but I think we've done a really good job at healing the rifts that are out there. And we've got a ton of common ground when it comes to effective conservation that helps bring the fish back. And, natural resource economy, we are in pretty much the same place as tribes are. We also are the ones that are there with some social problems that we can help with. And I think one of the greatest bills of this session, the last two sessions actually, was Representative Gina Mosbrucker and her disappearance of Indigenous women bills, where this was a nationwide problem. She was the first legislator in the country to identify it and understand that it's because we're not effectively sharing information across jurisdictions. And tribes are pretty careful about that, by the way, because they've been abused a lot. But she brought a study bill that was passed last year, and it was supposed to report back later. She didn't want to lose the year, so because they'd already had the meetings, they knew what they needed to do, she brought the follow-up bill this year. And there are follow-up bills now in states clear across the country and nationally. So disappearance of Indigenous women, many of whom are trafficked, was a problem that most of us didn't know existed, and all of a sudden we've got Republicans leading on how we can help solve that. Now, I've got to be careful here, because it was tribal women that really, I think, provided most of the impetus here. It was just Gina that was able to bring the bill.
Maya, I'm going to throw this one to you. How do Republican agendas of controlling the right to choose and anti-trans, et cetera, reflect Republican values of small government interference in state rights?
Okay, I got a question for you. Name one anti-trans bill. Ay nada. There are none. The messaging, however, is that we are anti-trans. Absolutely untrue. Sorry?
The bathroom bills.
We sponsored a gender-only bathroom bill. What was it? We didn't. There were some members that voted against a gender-neutral bathroom bill. That may be true. Vote your district. Vote your conscience. We did not sponsor any legislation that is anti-anyone, to my knowledge, this year. Hey, I can't go back in history.
Do we have time for one more question? Yeah, just one more. Why support unchecked capitalism as a party when it's disproportionately impacting red areas of the state?
Oh, there's a lot packed into that question. I mean, first of all, there's a premise that we support unchecked capitalism. That would suggest that you'd have zero regulations, zero statutes, basically no rule of law, and that just isn't true. I mean, I think what we're asking for is a reasonable amount of regulation, and particularly the kinds of regulations that affect small businesses that can drown them in red tape. My biggest regret in not winning the election in 2012 was not being there to try to restore some balance because of the excessive burdens that are placed on smaller businesses. The big businesses can take care of themselves and show they can take care of themselves every single session. They have good lawyers, good lobbyists, lots of money, a lot of sophistication, and they care about this state. But the small businesses, like the cosmetologists, just get creamed unless they manage to show up in enough numbers. So, you know, the rural areas of the state vote Republican more and more because they feel alienated from central government, and they feel, you know, increasingly burdened by rules made by people living in Olympia or Seattle or Bellevue. And, you know, I think they're electing Republicans because those candidates are saying, we're going to try to help you with that. But the idea that there's unchecked capitalism is not a world that any of us really lives in, because it doesn't exist. Not with the government we have today and the multiple layers of government in America.
Okay, time. thank you very much. Thank you for your great questions. Enjoy the rest of the fest.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Resty Bacall and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And to sign up for announcements about the next Crosscut Festival, go to crosscut.com/festival. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.